sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here. We are down to subpoint M under Roman numeral 6, happiness as it relates to the local church. One, the principle of happiness is realized in the local church through the function of the pastor teacher and the principle of face-to-face teaching. 1 John 1:3-4 indicates that the content, of course, of our message focuses on the person and work of Jesus Christ, and that ultimately the fellowship that the adjusted communicator shares with the Lord, he desires for the congregation to share with him and the Lord directly. What we have seen in verse 3 and heard, we proclaim also to you, so that you too may have fellowship with us. Now, John's subtle here, but the implication is if you don't have fellowship with John, you don't have fellowship with the Lord. He doesn't come out and say that directly, but that's the implication of what he's saying, is that your fellowship with us is contingent upon you listening and orienting to the principles of our teaching. And indeed, he says, our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. These things we write so that our joy may be made complete. And again, in the understanding of the temporary period during the first century of the church age, during the apostolic period, there was an inability, of course, for the 12 apostles, ultimately, Paul being the 12th one that replaced Judas, to be in more than one geographical place at one time. So obviously they were limited in terms of what they could do face to face. Well, all these letters that we have in the New Testament are nothing more than their best, second best, shot at face-to-face. When they couldn't be face-to-face, they would write letters. And so these letters that are extant, and not all of them are, there was another epistle, say, to the Corinthians that did not make it into the canon. Whether it was destroyed or whether it wasn't fully inspired, we don't know. We know that Paul talks about at least three letters that he's written to them, but we only have two in our Bible. So there's also reference to a letter to the church at Laodicea that was written by Paul, but did not make it into the canon. And so, again, whether they were destroyed or what happened to them, we don't know. But when they couldn't be face-to-face, they were forced into secondary situations that they had to use. I mean, either that or there was no communication at all. And so, because of this, we actually have our Bible. 2 John 12 will spell out, of course, his issue in all of this. And that they never really wanted, and Paul says this to the Thessalonians and to some other groups, that I really want to be there face to face, that this is the preferred method, that there isn't anything better than that. Though he says in verse 12, I have many things to write to you. I do not want to do so with paper and ink, but I hope to come and speak to you face to face so that your joy may be made full. And, of course, a part of full joy, then, is this principle of face-to-face teaching. In our days, this is very much under attack because of technology. Technology does not replace the necessity for face-to-face teaching. People out there who live on tapes and CDs and the Internet and other things, whatever they get, television shows now, radio programs, there are, quote, a lot of ways to, we might say, get the truth. But number one, what level of truth are you getting with these things? That's my first question, is what level of truth are they even dealing with? And some of it is very lacking, some of it is suspect, and some of it is flat wrong. So you have this ability now, because of technology, for people to not have to assemble and face-to-face. Well, that doesn't change the royal imperative in Hebrews 10:25. It doesn't mitigate against that, just because people can get around it. Do not leave off the assembling of yourselves together. Enkatalipo is the verb there, and it means to stop doing something you were previously doing. It means to abandon. It can even have a stronger term of forsake. But in the context, it basically deals with the fact that these Hebrew believers at one time were assembling regularly for face-to-face, and they began over a course of time to let that slide. And so the local church, we insist that the best method, the preferred method, is face-to-face teaching. All other methods are inferior and are substitutes, in fact, for what people should be doing, which is face-to-face. And this has led to many many aberrations. Now you have entire groups out there who are don't have a pastor, don't have to deal with... See, one of the reasons you have to have face-to-face is you have to deal with authority. Well, the tape, you don't have to do that. You can just turn it off. Oh, you said something I don't like. Well, you can't turn me off today. Now, you can tune me out, but you can't turn me off. And so with things in the internet, and then, of course, there's all the distractions. I don't know about you, but I knew when I had to make up, and back then we had cassette tapes, well, when I was in class, you had to make up a tape, or you had to order the tape. And normally it would be ready within 15 or 20 minutes after Bible class. It wasn't like it wasn't quick. It was pretty quick. And but then you had to listen to it. And then if you had a class the next night and you had to work all day, well, when were you going to listen to it? It wasn't convenient to make up classes. It's still not convenient to make up classes. It's not designed to be. And so some of us over the years as pastors, we've kind of discussed this amongst ourselves, that what if we just decide to take all of our teaching, make it unavailable except other than face-to-face? And then people have to either assemble and get it or they don't. And you don't get it if you don't assemble. We've mostly decided against that for a few reasons. But the question is begged, how much are people profiting out there when they don't even have a local church, essentially? They've got a hologram teaching them. Well, holograms aren't real people. They're modeled off of real people, but they're not real. They're not tangible. And so obviously another old issue in face-to-face is you have to be in a particular geographic locale and the pastor has to be able to see you and at some level has to be aware of who you are and what your spiritual issues are. You can't do that from a distance. You can't do that with an FX hookup. You can't do that with Skype or whatever, FaceTime. You know, now they're sitting out there, whole congregation sitting there on FaceTime listening to somebody 1,000 miles away. That is as stupid as anything I've ever heard. And that is so indefensible from a biblical standpoint. Say, well, technology's making it easier. Easier to what? Easier to blow off what the scriptures say we should be doing. And I'm aware of entire, quote, Bible study groups that call themselves churches that don't have a head. We're a local body. Where's your head? Don't have one. Really? Well, I don't think you're much of a body then. I think you're just a corpse going through the motions, is what I think, personally. And so this matter of authority, you can blow that off because if you don't have face-to-face. Also, you never have anybody getting in your face about your problems. Because let's face it, if a guy's 1,000 miles, how am I going to pastor somebody that's in Kansas? I don't know what they're going through up there. They could be under all manner of testing that I wouldn't know anything about. How could I know? So there has to be this geographic, there has to be this organic unity within a local church. There's a number of things that have to be present to have a local church situation. Listening to tapes from 1,000 miles isn't one of them. Skype isn't one of them. That's not face-to-face teaching. You say, well, it's close. Well, and then, there's two games where it doesn't matter if it's close. And that's horseshoes and hand grenades. Close isn't good enough. But somebody needs to stand up and say this. Close isn't good enough, people. That listening online, doing all this stuff, that isn't the same as face-to-face. Do not fool yourself. But again, there are whole groups out here that are completely deluded on this. And that is not helpful. Well, two, an adjusted congregation is the source of joy for the adjusted pastor. Apart from which relationship, neither can effectively fulfill its destiny in time or eternity. We are intertwined, our lives become intertwined with one another in a local church as a part of an organic body of Christ. And 1 Thessalonians 2, 19 and 20, as he talks about the Thessalonians. And look at this in verse 18. We were earnestly desiring in verse 17 to see your face. He wants face-to-face teaching. He makes no secret about it. And yet people gloss over these verses like they don't matter. This is face-to-face teaching. We wanted to come more than once. And yet Satan hindered us. Why is Satan so against this? Well, that's a part of his evil plan. Because if this is God's plan, believe me, he's going to substitute something else for it. And generally, something with a plausible rationale. Well, I'm getting the information. Well, the information says you need face-to-face. Oh, well, yeah, but... Well, how much are you getting the information if you're blowing off what the primary objective is? when the primary objective is face to face. So he said, who is our hope or joy or crown of exaltation? Is it not even you in the presence of our Lord Jesus at his coming? For you are our glory and our joy. Because ultimately, my destiny is wrapped up in you maximizing spiritually. That's exactly the only thing I'm here for, is for you to maximize spiritually, to take what I know and impart it to you. And guess what? You don't know everything I know. I can guarantee you that. And I don't know everything the Lord knows. I'm constantly in a state of learning as well. But again, Paul, God has set up this standard that where we have this earthly example. You say, everybody says, oh, I love God, but I hate the pastor. Well, it's hard to hate God's representative and love God. As a matter of fact, I would say it's impossible. But you have this human example full of failures, foibles, just like you are. Isn't perfect, has to rebound, doesn't do it right, has to get up and fight the fight every day just like you do. Well, people worship God, but God's sort of above all this, is he not? God doesn't agonize over getting up in the morning. He never hits the snooze button. You know. He doesn't agonize over, oh my God, what's going to happen today? For those of us, we talk about it, but for those of us who are homeowners, the joy of homeownership. And all that brings with it. Well, God isn't agonized about any of this stuff. We have to get up and deal with it. Well, you have this human who sets an example. An imperfect example, but an example nonetheless. And you're to follow that example. So, essentially, however I order my life, you need to make it your business to order your life the same way. I mean, obviously, the specifics have to be worked out. Like, you have to have a job, most likely, and you know, obviously you can't get the same job I've got. You can't imitate me perfectly. I mean, but you're not designed to at that level. Obviously you've got your area of expertise. And the same thing's true in spiritual gifts. You each have your own spiritual gift. It's not the same as mine necessarily. But all these things go together. And again, in this issue of face-to-face teaching, you've got this body dynamic that's absent in non-face-to-face teaching. And so you don't fellowship with other believers when you don't assemble. You don't get the encouragement, the comfort. And who knows what what night you'll come to class and you'll feel crappy. And somebody will tell you they had a crappier day than you did. And you'll walk away feeling better. Oh, you think you've been tested. I was watching some old stuff back when they were trying to resurrect Saturday Night Live in the 80s. And I remember this skit they always had on there. Oh, I hate it when that happens. Well, you come to class and somehow you get encouraged. You don't even know necessarily. But this is a part of the body dynamic that you can't get through tapes and online and all these other factors. So here, our destiny's tied up together. Mine is to take you as far spiritually as you can go. And that's it. That's my one objective. That's it. It makes my niche real simple. I just got to commit myself to studying and teaching at the highest level possible in order to attain the goal, which is for you to get maximum glory, phase three, and maximum blessing in time. I want you to have both. That's always my prayer. You'll prosper and be in good health, even as your soul. But soul prosperity's got to come first, and that involves orientation to the Bible. And that's where soul prosperity comes from. Well, three, as believers hear and apply the doctrine they are taught, they become the source of joy and time for the pastor teacher. The pastor, obviously, is there to teach them, Philemon, 1:7. This is a book we don't cite very much. It's an interesting little book about this runaway slave, Onesimus, and how Paul wrote this guy and told him he was a dirty bugger for owning slaves and how he ought to get rid of him and all that. No, he didn't. Didn't do that at all. Paul said, I'm sending him back because he's your slave and he's your property and I know it. And, he can be a help to me, so I'm asking you if in your kindness you might free him to help me. That's what this letter is all about. But number one, it shows Paul's real understanding of the cultural norms and all in which he lived during that time. And secondarily, his willingness to orient to those things. And thirdly, his humility. Because as an apostle, he could have ordered this guy to do this. But he doesn't. He doesn't say, hey, I need him. You need to set him free so he can stay here in Rome. Philemon 1:7. For I have come to have much joy and comfort in your love. This is to Philemon. because the hearts of the saints have been refreshed through you, brother. And this fact, this guy applied, and as he applied, Paul became aware of it. And again, people who are applying, you can't hide it. And people who aren't, you can't hide it either. So you can't hide what you are in the long term. And so Philemon had made a lot of applications, and they've been a source of comfort to Paul. Also 3 John 1, 3 and 4. And so as believers get the doctrine and apply it, and you see him making the hard choices, making the hard applications, standing up for the truth, holding their ground spiritually, it's an encouragement. And again, you get the full spectrum as a pastor. You get everything from the encouragement to the kick in the butt. And it just depends on the individual believer. And it can be the same believer just depending upon their time and their little history with you. That some days they can be very encouraging and comforting, and other days, if I had hair, I would be pulling it out. And thank God I don't have any certain days, because I would be bald by now. And so, you know. Well, 3 and 4, for I was very glad when the brothers came and testified to your truth. That is how you are walking in the truth, that you order your life according to the principles of the truth. I have no greater joy than this, to hear of my children walking in the truth. That's true of every adjusted communicator. If every pastor that I know of that I've ever met would tell you the same thing. That when you see believers growing and applying, that is a source of great comfort and joy, and serves as a motivation for me to do better. This is one of the things in the whole face-to-face scenario. Without seeing one another, how can you ever know who's applying, who isn't? How can you ever be comforted and encouraged in your own niche in certain ways? As you see, you fight the same fight. Well, for the adjusted communicator recognizes the great value of unity in the local church. As the congregation unites in the divine viewpoint he teaches, his joy is increased. Philippians 2:2. And so, again, this is why our doctrine, our position is that we don't unify around a pastor or a personality. We unify around the truth. And so, as I've said for the 25 years I've been teaching here, I don't want to hear people, oh, well, Ron teaches blah, blah, blah. No, what does the Bible teach? We're not interested in what Ron teaches. Is this clearly documentable within the pages of Scripture? Do you see this? And if you see it, then you know it's true, then okay, fine. But what we're interested in is not the communicator. He is simply a conduit for the truth. That's all he is. And that's all he'll ever be. And he can serve to be an example in terms of priorities and the function of the local church and setting an example in face-to-face teaching and making the sacrifices and all that. But beyond all that, he's just simply a conduit for the truth. An agent whom God the Holy Spirit uses as he sees fit. And so, as he sees the congregation grow up and orient, we unify around the truth, not around people. Make my joy complete, he says. First he says, if there's any encouragement, any consolation, any fellowship, any affection and compassion, and the church of brotherly love, and this is what we should aspire to be, the Philadelphia church in Revelation. The only church out of all those seven that had nothing leveled against it. Now, it was small, didn't have a lot of numbers, didn't have a lot of money, was insignificant in many ways from a cosmic perspective. But, he says, you are rich, and because you've kept my word, I'm going to keep you from that hour, which is about to try the whole earth. But the point of all of it is, he never had a negative thing to say about it. He said, because you have a little strength, I set before you an open door which no man can shut. And I take that simply to mean that as long as we're oriented to the truth and loyal to doctrine, that God will provide a forum whereby the truth will always be here. But don't you take that for granted. Well, the truth will always be here, so it doesn't matter how faithful I am. Well, yes, it does. It absolutely does. Because at some level, all of our lives are intertwined, whether we like it or not. And you better get used to these people. Look around. You're going to be spending eternity with them. So you say, well, I don't like some of them. It's fine. They don't like you either. So don't think you're all that in a bag of chips. We all have our little warts and all, you know. All have our little problems and flaws and blemishes. But doctrine can overcome all that. The unity of spirit and the bond of peace. Love, affection, compassion, brotherly love. This is what, well, that's what Philadelphia means, the church of brotherly love. And again, using philos, the term for affection and the emotional aspects of love as opposed to agape love, which focuses more on the object of love than it does on how you feel about the love, or the object even. So if there's any of this, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind, regard one another as more important than yourself. If you succeed with these two verses, you will succeed in the Christian life. Because if you put other people first, you are fulfilling the law of love. And that's all it's about. Denying yourself and putting others first and serving them. And in my case, I do it through the teaching aspect. You have to do it through the application aspect. It's not that I never have to apply, but this is why I'm here, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry. Five, therefore, the joy of the pastor teacher and the joy of the congregation are contingent upon each other in some ways, as each seeks to orient to God's plan in time. 2 Corinthians 1:24. And again, this is, we have to choose this every day. It's a conscious choice. You have to get up and be committed to fighting the fight. Say, I'm tired of fighting the fight. Sound like George Thorogood. Well, I'm tired. Well, I don't think you want to fight the fight. I don't think you're looking for a job. Well, 2 Corinthians 1:24. I know too much music now. It's been my downfall in life. But there's a song that addresses almost every issue of the human experience. It's been addressed. Verse 24, as he says, now, God is my witness that to spare you, because he tells these Corinthians, you guys are screwed up big time. And if I come there right now, it's not going to be fun, because I am going to skin some of you alive. Some of you need to be skinned. And this is going to be rough on some of you. And he said, so I'm not coming right now, because you don't want to deal with me right this second. Hey, you know, you won't like me when I get there. And of course, half of them are thinking, we don't like you now. But, you know, that's a different deal. But he says, not that we lord it over your faith. No, we don't. The pastor's not the pope. No pastor is a pope. We answer to God, but obviously we have to be humble in all of that ourselves. If we have no real, we consider we have no peers, we have nobody we answer to, we have no way of checking ourselves, well, that to me is nonsense. Just because you're a pastor of a church doesn't put you above everything. We all have accountability factors that we have to have. But we're not here to play Pope over you. We're lording it over your faith. But we are workers for you, or with you, for your joy. I want you to be happy. But you're not going to be happy apart from orientation to these principles. I found out the hard way. Learn from me. Be happy. But the way to happiness is found right here. The key, you know, I like that movie, The Shawshank Redemption. The key to the happiness lies within. And it did. And it was the Bible, of course. And, of course, he found a little pick to put in his Bible. And it did lie within, as it turns out. So that in your faith, you are standing firm. See, people begin to doubt. They begin to question. You have to be there to prop them up sometimes and to strengthen them and tell them, you know, no, here's the doctrine. Here's the divine viewpoint on the matter. This is what you need to orient to and line up with. You say, I don't want to orient to it and line up with it. Well, I can't do anything about that. That's your call. But I can at least spell it out plainly. Here's the divine viewpoint on this matter. And you can think whatever you choose to think. Obviously, I can't control your thinking, nor would I try to. I can barely control mine. How could I control yours? But all I can do is set forth the truth and say, these are the issues, and then you deal with them. And in the end, the goal is you to be happy. So I think some people come to class and they think, well, he just wants to make me miserable. No, it's not it. Not here to make you miserable. Hebrews 13:17. Obey your leaders and submit to them. Why? Because they keep watch over your souls. See, I'm tasked with a pretty tough job. I'm going to have to answer for every one of the sheep and how what condition they're in. Now, here's where it all changes, because obviously sheep, at a certain level is true in the physical realm, sheep can wander away. But sheep wander away because why? They're stupid. There's no other reason a sheep leaves the flock. It's because he's stupid. And guess what? He'll ultimately become a casualty because of that stupidity. If he stays away from the flock long enough, he will be subject to a predator at some point. And, you know, that's it. Or some other deal. You know, sheep, I've seen these survival shows. I've seen the one recently. I don't know if you caught the one with Bear Grylls takes out celebrities. That one's funny. And I mean, he scares the daylights out of them. I saw this one up in Scotland, you know, and there's this dead sheep at the bottom of a ravine. It fell. It was so stupid it wandered over the cliff. And that's sheep. And so the goal, of course, obviously for the enemy is pretty simple. Divide and conquer. And that's another whole thing for the face-to-face deal. Divide them, cull them out of the herd little by little until then one day you have them. That's the goal. And so, why? Because I have to answer for all of this. They keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this would be unprofitable for you. Yeah, well, when the pastor thinks of you and all he does is go, that's not good. You don't want to be that believer. You want to be the believer when the pastor thinks of him, he goes, huh, that's a good believer. They're oriented. They're trying. They're, you know, they may not be perfect. I don't expect any of you to be perfect. I'm not. So I don't expect it out of you. But the reality is we set a high standard and we're not changing that. And the standard will be high. But those who attain to that standard, I mean, we're talking better than the Olympic gold medal. What you've got to look forward to. Take any sort of temporal fame and accomplishment and achievement. Winning the Super Bowl, winning the NBA title, winning the World Series, winning a gold medal in the Olympics. I'm the best human in the world at luge. Doesn't translate well into the job market. Not a lot of call for losers, you know. And that gold medal won't get you much. I mean, people eventually, unfortunately, sell them because they can't make any money losing. If you want to be best at something, I'd want to be the best heavyweight boxer. That's what I'd want to be. But even then, boxing, there's not a lot of call for. There's still some out there, but it's becoming a sport of the past, sadly. I mean, it has its good qualities, I think, but also it's brutal. It can be violent. Well, again, so you don't want it to be unprofitable for you. What you want to look for is maximum profit. How do you get maximum profit? Let your leader think of you with joy. That's the key. That's one of it. So you have to deal with that. Well, and children are a part of the phase two happiness that God provides, Psalm 127, 3 through 5. And as all parents know, children are a mixed bag, aren't they? It's not like every day you get up and say, oh, thank you, Jesus. And thankfully, it's not like every day you get up and think, I want to kill myself. Hopefully, it's a mixed bag. But in the end, they're designed to be a blessing. If they grow up and become positive, adjusted, contributing believers, that's as good as you can do. That's all you really have to do. And really, your job as parents is to teach them how to live the Christian life. That's the most important thing. You know, well, my job is, there are other factors go with that, obviously, like discipline and instruction and other factors. But if you raise a positive, adjusted believer, that's the best you can do, really, for them. Whatever their other phase two niche holds, whether it's education, lack of education, high-paying job, middle-paying job, low-paying job, you know, there's no work that's unproductive, and there's no work that's should be denigrated. All work is honorable. You say, well, I don't want my kid growing up being a garbage collector. Why? Do you want your garbage piling up out there at the curb forever? No, you want garbage collectors. And hopefully you want them to be paid. I don't want them doing it for free. And so we have aspirations and all that, but sometimes we have to learn as parents to put all that aside and say, you know what, God, what you want for my children is what's important, not what I want. And my views could be fallible. They could be wrong, you know. I've watched parents push their children down all kinds of manner of paths in life, and most of them bad. because they have these preconceived ideas that it's a cookie cutter society and everybody needs to be the same. Everybody should go to college. Everybody should do this. Everybody should do that. Some children, one of our kids was not college material, believe me. And to send them to college would have been stupid. But they could learn a trade. And so this is how the Jewish society worked. Essentially, if you were a young man, and the emphasis, of course, because it was a patriarchal society, if you were a young man, you were determined early on whether or not, by the time you were 13, 14, 15, whether or not you were prepared to study the Torah, if you wanted to be a professional rabbi. And if you weren't, then all the rest of these kids went into Votech, essentially. Not that they couldn't learn other things. They could. But essentially, they learned a skill, a trade, so that they could make it in life and live. Joseph happened to be a carpenter. He was not an educated man. Jesus wasn't particularly educated. He was from the peasant class. And I think he did okay. I'm going to take my chances on that Jesus did okay in the scheme of God's plan. And again, we're not against education. We're not against success. We're not against... But again, certain things in this, when they pursue all this, becomes conducive to lifestyles that aren't conducive to doctrine in the local church. Again, there's many careers that are not compatible with being here. And you can probably name a lot of them. Anything that would require extensive travel is not conducive to what you're supposed to be doing as a believer here. And so that could be anything. Airline pilots. Now, I'm glad we have airline pilots. But you need them. You hope they're not drunk. I watched that Denzel Washington flight. You hope they're not coked up from the night before. You hope he doesn't have to land the plane upside down. But the point of all of that is, again, being gone 5 days a week, that's not conducive to Bible class. And again, you can pick many, many, many careers that are not conducive to this. So the idea, well, I need to be CEO so I can move to, blah, blah, blah. So then they move to Timbuktu where there's no church. And they die on the vine spiritually, but they make a lot of money. There are people who've traded doctrine for that. They trade doctrine for temporal happiness. I want to live a particular lifestyle. If you're at least partially criminal, you can move to Alaska because they can't find you to speak of. If you find they go out far enough. Just don't have a Discovery film crew with you. But they make it pretty plain up there. There's a lot of people up there, not because they're outdoorsmen or hunters. Some of them are. But there are a lot of people up there because they're skirting the law. And it's kind of a dangerous place. Well, I'd rather be in a place that's safe and also where I could get face-to-face teaching. So a lot of things aren't conducive to this. But again, children here, verse 3, are a gift of the Lord. And I take this as a subjective genitive. The Lord is the one who gives the gift. The fruit of the womb is a reward, like arrows in the hand of a warrior. So are the children of one's youth. How blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be ashamed when they speak with their enemies in the gate. And why are children so important? Well, children are important for a lot of reasons. Number one, they constitute the next generation. And you have these dreams, as a parent for your children. You hope to hear them saying, and welcome to the Harvard commencement. And then you have this other dream. Do you want fries with that? the nightmare part of it. The point of all of this is that children can be a blessing. But all we're here to do is guide them in the path of doctrine. Really, that's the most important thing. That's got to be our priority. Whatever they become under that, you just have to kind of accept. You say, well, my will is for them to do thus and such. That doesn't mean it's God's will. You better make sure on that one that your will and God's will coincide. And I've watched parents who live their lives through their children, vicariously. And I think maybe some parents at some level always do this, maybe not as bad as others. I've watched some that are really bad. I've watched mothers that are so wrapped up in their teenage daughter's life, you would think it was their boyfriend. That's disgusting to me. That's sick. How are you and Joe doing today? Who cares? It's none of your business, frankly. Because I've watched all that. And another reason children are valuable is because they teach orientation to authority. See, a wife, when she gets married, she gets this husband, this authority. And he's, in a sense, God. Now, obviously, he's fallible, and you don't have to listen to everything he says. Obviously, if he tells you to violate doctrine, you don't have to do that. There's nothing in the Bible that says you have to do that. We got examples of this, like the midwives in Egypt. The government told them, Pharaoh told them, kill the babies. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. Daniel was told by the government, you can't pray. Daniel didn't have to do that. He could pray. And so nobody has authority to abrogate God's laws. No authority does. But a man, you know, other than that, you got to basically obey him and listen to him. Until he tells you to violate doctrine, then you don't have to do that. Or he tells you to commit some criminal activity, that's another violation. You don't have to do that. You know, you don't have to be a mule carrying his heroin for him. You know, not that men would ever use women like that, of course. Right. But you don't have to obey those things. Those things you're exempt from because God's law trumps man's law. God's authority trumps man's authority every time. Be it the government, be it the husband, be it even parents. If parents are abusive, God's law really trumps that. So the point of all this is a woman gets this authority. Well, okay, she has to deal with that end of it. Then she has to deal with, okay, I got to orient to my husband here. But if she gets kids, this really changes the dynamic. Because now she suddenly sees, holy crap, I've got authority. And now I'm responsible for these little people. Not that the husband isn't, he is too. I mean, it should be a team effort. But the point is, then she has to deal with this matter of authority now from the middle perspective, where she's under authority, but she's also in authority. And so now she sees the value of authority in a way that she didn't see it before, maybe. And this is a part of the phase two deal where Paul says women will be saved through, delivered in time through the bearing of children. One, it really works against that Eve complex that the women inherit, unfortunately, genetically. That's just the way it is. Some women have it worse than others, but some have it really bad. Some don't have it too bad. But the deal, I know what I'm doing and I'm the boss and I'm in charge and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to lead Adam to paradise. No, you're not. You were in paradise, dopey. It was called the Garden of Eden, the paradise of God. Why was it called that? Well, that's what it was. And so the idea, again, that children play into this is because you have now a situation where the mom's the authority. And she has to be obeyed just like any other authority. Any child that doesn't obey their parent should be punished, you know, depending upon the child and all, with the appropriate punishment. You don't tolerate that, you know. You just don't tolerate them smarting off, bad attitude. You know, you got the right to tell them, you better check that attitude at the door. Don't bring it in here because that's not going to fly. And so then she has to deal with authority from a different level. Well, that's a part of a bigger dynamic that makes children a real blessing in God's plan. That you have to deal with things that you wouldn't ordinarily deal with. See, I was one of these, and I never wanted kids at all, period. And yet it became very clear to me in God's plan, okay, I want you to have these kids. And I thought, at first I was like, no. I don't want them. And are you not listening? Which part of no do you not understand, God? And he goes, well, I understand you all right. But I have a plan. And I see now it was to my benefit. So I learned a lot of things. And all of that with having kids that I wouldn't have learned otherwise. I mean, and that's not everybody's niche. I get it. Not everybody's unique in that regard, or identical, rather. But the fact is, it was a big deal. Made a big difference in how I approach life. And it also makes a big difference in how the advice now I would give to parents. I've been through it. I know how it works. I've seen the outcome of it. And you can do, as a parent, I can tell you right now, you could do everything right and your children can grow up to be idiots. Or you can do everything wrong and, God help them, somehow they survive. But the deal is we still have our royal imperatives as parents on what we're supposed to do. Like not, you know, don't embitter your children. Don't exasperate them. Give them reasonable commands. And then expect reasonable compliance. They don't have to be perfect. But when they smart off and when they think they don't have to obey, it's your job to make sure they know they do. You're doing them a favor in the end. Because rejection of authority will get them into a lot of trouble in time. And if they can't obey authority in the house, wait till they get them a job. And some idiot boss is in their face. I mean, you got different kinds of bosses, as Peter said there. You have the kind and reasonable, and then you have the unreasonable. And you get an unreasonable boss, and if you can't orient to authority, well, you're going to crack under it. Then you'll quit, you'll walk off the job, and you'll be a failure. And you need to confront that. But walking off of a job is a tacit mark of failure. And that's all it is. You say, well, the boss was horrible. Welcome to the world, Arthur. You spoiled little. There are more horrible bosses out there than there are good ones, believe me. And so, but if you don't know how to orient to authority, well then, if they haven't learned that, it's going to be tough out there. Well, one is the relationship between the pastor and congregation, the child that hears and applies doctrine, becomes a source of great happiness to the parents that raised him. Proverbs 23, 24, and 25. And at the end of it all, as a parent, the good thing is we're off the hook once they hit about 18. They're on their own then. If they want to go out and be idiots, can't stop them. And what you need at the end of the day as a parent is a clear conscience. Well, I did right. I did right by this kid. I raised him, took care of him, did right by him. Told him what was important. And if they blow it off, that's their business. But I did the right things overall. And you're, nobody, parent's going to be perfect. So you'll have your doubts and your regrets. And everybody has that in life. In general, but in parenting, you'll have it too. But overall, I know I've got a passing grade when it came to parenting. I wasn't perfect, but I got a passing grade on that one. Well, Proverbs here, 23, 24, and 25. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and mother be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you. And the idea here is that let your eyes, as he says in verse 26, delight in my ways. As a parent, you want to set a doctrinal example that you say to your children, this is how we do it and this is where we go. And it starts with the husband. He's the first responsible authority, then the wife, and then the family as a whole. But again, you have to have somebody in charge, somebody that sets the standard. Proverbs 27:11. And this is why one of the things we're going to see coming up in Romans here is that you'll see that the reasoning that people say, well, if you study the Bible carefully, you would say, well, how come the fall is never attributed to Eve? She's the one that cracked. That's right, she is. Satan went to Eve and tempted her. Why? He knew she was the weak link. And so he cracks the weak link. Well, good for him. What a genius. Wow, that's good. You picked on the weaker vessel. Wow, aren't you proud, Satan? You and your great spiritual genius and all that you are, this was the best you could come up with. Pick the weaker vessel and go on her. Well, that's what he did. But see, do you think Satan plays fair? Do you think he cares about the rules? No. And so somebody say, well, why Eve ate first? Why didn't she get blamed for the fall? Because Adam was the authority. And that's where the buck stops. The buck always stops with the authority. And so in the family, it's the man. It's the husband. The buck stops there. And he's going to answer for all this, by the way. The authority that didn't lead his wife in the paths of righteousness, that didn't encourage her with doctrine and all of that, I wouldn't want to be in his... If he's a believer, if he's an unbeliever, well, he's going to spend eternity in the lake of fire. But if he's a believer, I wouldn't want to be in his shoes at the Bema Seat. I would not want to be in his shoes. I would be afraid of that. That's where the fear of God really comes in handy. That, oh boy, I'm going to have to give a response for this woman too now. The woman that you gave me. In a good sense, I guess, right? Well, you wonder at times, but still the buck stops there because the authority is the one that's going to answer for it. And so the fall, as we're going to see in Romans, is constantly attributed to Adam. By one man, the sin nature entered into the world. And spiritual death through the sin nature. Through the fall of Adam, through one transgression, the many were made sinners. By one transgression, condemnation came upon all. By the condemnation of one man. It's always one man. Adam is the authority. So this is kind of good news for the wife in that you're exempt from certain things because the husband's going to answer for them. But you still have your obligations under the godliness code, so you'd best learn the godliness code for the wife and work on your niche. Another old principle. I love this. There was this play, and I never went and saw it, but I heard the name of it, and I just thought it was hilarious. I love you, you're perfect, please change. And this is how people are when they're married or when they're dating. I love you, you're perfect. When they get married, please change. So, wait a second. But they were perfect 6 weeks ago or 6 months ago. What happened? Oh, you found out they had warts and all. Well, guess what? Wives, you're not going to change your husband. Husbands, you're probably not going to change your wives. You pray for, set the right example and all of that, but that's all you can do at a certain level. I mean, you can enforce authority at a level she can't on you. But the fact is, you better just pray about it. And of course, the women have their royal imperatives in this regard, like 1 Peter 3 there, about the Sarah's daughters. Proverbs 27:11, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad, that I may have a reply for him who reproaches me. Also 29:3, a man who loves wisdom makes his father glad, but he who keeps company with hookers wastes his wealth. Yeah, well, did you ever see that show, Two and a Half Men? Charlie's the example of that. He's the type of son you didn't want. This guy had it wrong on so many levels. So again, the pursuit of wisdom, children can be a source of great happiness. Unfortunately, the opposite is also true. When a child rejects the principle of truth, he becomes a source of lupe. The Greek term lupe means a distress, grief, pain, or sorrow. I got distress in there twice. It's very distressful. Or sorrow. I guess distress is a synonym for distress. But it's not redundant. Proverbs 10:1, and this is always funny. I see this in these Hispanic cultures. They name their kids Lupe. It's like naming your kid nothing. Like Abel essentially meant nothing. We named our one kid Acquisition. We named our other kid Nothing. We named our one boy Joy. We named our daughter Sorrow. Well, I don't know about some of the ideas of names, where people get them, but 10:1, the Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Also, Proverbs 12:20-21. Well, that doesn't look right. Let's see. Proverbs 12:20. No, that's not it. So, okay. Well, I don't know. We'll have to find that one, I guess. There's a lot of good ones in here. We could read almost any of them. by the way, in a general sense, they're all true. Here, like in 13:20, I looked at that. He who walks with wise men will be wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm. Well, this is why we teach our children not to hang out with fools. Because we know that in the end, they're going to hurt them. The bad things can happen. But again, I don't know what that... I mean, maybe it's supposed to be 22 or 21. And 11. I mean, look, we got 12 seconds here, so I'll give it one more shot. 22, 20. Yeah, no, but... This is good too, but you know, we can't read the whole Proverbs today, so I'm just going to take my lumps on that one and move on. But our time is up anyway, so we will pick up here on Wednesday. Let's see, we've got a few more pages. Yeah, we probably will take Wednesday at least. So, but we'll get back to Romans here as soon as we wrap this up. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this time together. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls in Christ's name.